sum up the arc of a life that could be, you know, up to 100 years in 1600 words. It's a very specific kind of writing.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. That was the journalist Nigel Williamson, who specialises in writing obituaries for the Times newspaper in the UK. It's important to me on this podcast to have a huge variety of writers doing different things, and while some of them have been quite famous, others are doing very interesting work with a less high profile. Nigel has been a journalist for more than 40 years and he has a very impressive CV that includes political writing and celebrity interviews, but you won't recognise his name from the obituary pages because the Times has a policy of running all obituaries anonymously because they're supposed to represent the newspaper rather than the writer. I don't know if it's immediately obvious to you why I would want to speak to an obituarist, but I think that by the end of the episode you will understand why it's so interesting. It's a very particular form of journalism to try and create a short but meaningful record of a person's life after they've gone. Nigel has specialised in writing the obituaries of musicians, which, as he points out, has made him very prolific because rock and roll is a high-risk profession. I sat down with him in March at the office of the Times in London Bridge, and we talked about the unique responsibility of writing about someone after their death, his research process and how he deals with the loved ones left behind, and how he manages to get to the essence of a person in the space of one or two newspaper pages. Before we start, I'm delighted to say that this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. Since they launched in 2011, over 180 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including the critically acclaimed authors Bonnie Garmus, Jane Harper and Kirsty Capes. Curtis Brown Creative run a wide range of courses covering a variety of topics and genres. If you're interested in bringing your own life story to the page, you might want to join their six-week online writing a memoir course with teaching videos, resources and writing tasks from best-selling non-fiction author Kathy Rensenbrink. Curtis Brown Creative have given me an exclusive discount to share with you, so use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing a memoir or any other 4 or 6 week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I'll be back at the end of the conversation, but for now, over to Nigel. So normally when I do these interviews, I go to the writers' home or their office and we sit in the place where they do their writing and we start by talking about that environment. But obviously we're not there, we're in the office at the Times, which is not where you actually work. So would you sort of paint a bit of a picture for me of where you do your writing?
Well, I live in a large, rambling old country house, and my writing is done in a room that is a sort of study lined with books. But the glory is that I look out of the window over the top of the computer and I see a field full of horses and sheep.
That's very nice. Do you think that helps you get the work done?
Yes, it does, actually, because you can only look at sheep for so long. And it's nice to know they're there, but they're not actually a distraction. They're more a sort of calming influence.
So what are the important things in that room in terms of you getting your work done?
Well, the computer, obviously. I still like to use reference books. So, you know, I've got a reasonably up-to-date Who's Who 2020, I think it is, to hand. And a thesaurus. Lots of things I could Google, but if I've got time, I certainly like to reach for a book. So they're important. All sorts of other knickknacks. You know, the desk is cluttered with, I don't know, old cricket balls and... which, you know, is a love of mine. And so, again, it's a sort of... comforter, I suppose, to have a cricket ball there, and perhaps if I get a little writer's block and get stuck, I might pick the ball up and toss it from one hand to the other and pretend I'm coming into bowl in a test match at Lord's.
And so how many years have you been working from home? Because for a long time you were in newsrooms, I assume.
Yes, but I went freelance in 1996, and have never worked in an office since. So that's 27 years. But yes, I mean, prior to that, I was a home news editor. I had a spell as a Westminster correspondent. I was diary editor. But yeah, I mean, the office was something I was quite glad to leave behind, really. The politics and the expense account, I was less pleased to leave behind. I mean, this was back in the days where, you know, there were generous expense accounts. And in fact, if I could tell this little story, when I first joined the Times, I was taken on one side by, should I name him? Phil Webster, who was a parliamentary correspondent, lobby correspondent, who explained to me what one could get away with in terms of expenses and lunches and so on and so forth. And very valuable advice it was too.
And what could you get away with? I mean, nowadays, I'd probably absolutely nothing.
Well, we went out to lunch most days, from Monday to Friday.
And you're not talking about a sandwich?
No, okay. No. We're talking about a two-course meal and a couple of bottles of wine on expenses. I mean, often it was genuinely lunching contacts, you know, and you'd hope to get a story out of it. I remember once taking David Mellor to lunch and making the mistake of handing him the wine list, and I could see his eyes going up and down it, and I'm sure he was looking for the most expensive bottle on the list,
knowing
that the Times was paying for it. But then, you know, if you weren't lunching a contact, we just used to go out to lunch with each other.
Sounds great.
Should I be saying this?
Oh yeah, it's fine. Did you notice, in terms of the actual getting the work done, a difference between being in a busy newsroom and then being at home in peace and quiet? And, you know, how did that affect your, you know, yeah, your working life?
I actually found it easier. I know some people find it difficult to work from home, and they need that kind of throb and buzz of the office and the interaction and, you know, what is it, the water cooler moment and all that sort of thing. But I actually found it far easier to concentrate and to write at home on my own.
I'm the same. I used to work in newspapers or magazines, you know, in various offices, but I much prefer sitting at home in silence and just getting, and also I think I'm more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, when I was editing, then that was fine in the office, and, you know, I really needed to be in the office, but I always actually found it quite hard to write as opposed to edit when I was in the office, and much, much easier at home.
So day to day these days, what are you writing?
I probably write about 4 obituaries for the paper a week.
That's a lot. And they're quite
sometimes
sort of chunky,
3. I mean, 3 to 4 a week, I would say. So it is a lot. It is a lot. And I started out really doing music obituaries. I mean, when I went freelance, I reinvented myself as a music writer. I had to decide what I wanted to do and what was I really interested in? And my two great loves were music and cricket. And I decided music was the way to go. So, you know, I did a lot of celebrity interviews for the paper, from Jagger to Bowie to, you know, everybody.
Wow.
Which is helpful now, because a lot of the people I end up writing obituaries of, I interviewed them 20 years ago. I still do a bit of music writing for other magazines, for Uncut, which is a rock magazine, and Songlines, which is a world music magazine. But yeah, the obituaries have really sort of taken over my working life in a way.
And what's your sort of routine in terms of when you're sitting down at your desk and how many hours a day you're writing?
I start early. I'm usually at my desk by 8:30. Actually, it's not as sort of 24/7 as it was. The last obituaries editor, a very nice chap called Simon Pearson, and we used to call him the man who never sleeps. And I'm sure he was like, he slept with one eye open, and you could get emails at any time of the day or night about someone who had died. And I, you know, still occasionally get the sort of 7 o'clock, 7 a.m. email. So people on the paper sort of keep their ear pretty close to the ground. But I start about 8 and work through. If I'm writing an obituary, I'd aim to deliver it by probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so they've got time to get it up on online. Sometimes you have to work quicker, and it has changed really with the sort of emphasis switching to online. It was much not easier, but one had more time to sort of nuance and finesse your copy when you were writing for the following day's paper, and it wasn't going off stone till 7:30 at night. Obviously, the bigger the name, the more the pressure to get it done quickly. And you then get into this sort of trade-off between the quality of the writing and just the speed of getting it up there.
My impression with obituaries is that some of them seem to run, you know, almost, and I don't just mean in the Times, but I mean across the board, some obituaries seem to go up very quickly when somebody dies, whereas sometimes you see obituaries emerge from somebody who has died, you know, maybe a few weeks ago. Or so I wonder if that's to do with just how famous they were and how much of a demand there is, or does the Times always run them quickly?
As you say, it depends how big the name is. Obviously, the big names, people want to read that not even the next day. They want to read it within
an hour. As soon as they hear that someone's died, yeah.
They turn on the news bulletin and they want to read a full 2,000-word obituary 5 minutes later. I think the longest gap ever... you see, the other thing is it's not always announced or learnt that somebody has died immediately. Priscilla Tolkien, the daughter of J.R.R., she died in April 2022, and nobody found out she died until October. And then the obituaries desk said to me, "We've got a great idea. She was the recipient of Tolkien's famous Father Christmas letters." And they said, "We'll run it on Christmas Day or Boxing Day or whatever the days of the week." I can't remember where the days of the week fell last Christmas. But anyway, it ran on Christmas Day or Boxing Day, and she died the previous April. But it was actually a perfect Christmas read.
I suppose famously obituaries are often prepared a long time before people actually go, especially if you have somebody who's a very big name. And I know that, you know, all the newspapers were working on packages around the Queen for a long time before she went. So how much of your work is that kind of early preparation for people who perhaps the rumour is that they're not very well, or it's just that they're now 90, so their days must be numbered? You know, how much of that is done ahead?
Yes, I mean, we call them stocks. And there's an extensive library of stocks just waiting the moment. I mean, on the Queen thing, I wasn't involved in that. But when I was news editor, it was the Queen Mother was still alive. And we had this sort of 16-page black-bordered supplement ready to go. And we used to have a sort of annual meeting and look at it and see where it needed updating. But yeah, I mean, the stocks are more vital than ever now, in fact, because I was talking about the pressure of getting it up swiftly online. And so, having the stock is very valuable. But over the years, I mean, I wrote my first obituary, I think, in 1997. I mean, somebody like Mick Jagger, I've probably done his obituary about 3 times so far.
Really? And does it become the case that sometimes you've got stocks that have been done such a long time ago that actually you're pretty much looking at a complete rewrite by the time they actually die?
And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But I mean, on Jagger, I probably did the first stock round about 1999. Then we updated it 10, 12 years later. Then a new obituaries editor came in with a completely different style. So, you know, I did it again for a third time and got paid 3 times for writing it as well. One might
thanks, Mick.
No, but the story I was going to tell you about the being out of date, towards the end of the 1990s, I suppose, Ian Brunskill, who was then the obituaries editor, rang me up and said, I've been looking at our Paul McCartney stock. It looks a bit mouldy. Could you have a go at updating it? And then he sent it over to me. And I discovered it had been written by Hunter Davis in 1968.
Oh, my God. That was very prepared of them. They must have thought, you know, he could have a rock and roll death and go very young.
Well,
or something.
There were rumours that Paul McCartney was dead. It was 68 or 69. And there was this crazy kind of conspiracy rumour doing the rounds that Paul had died. And there were all sorts of indications of this. If you look at the cover of Abbey Road, he's barefoot. And this was meant to be a secret message that the other three are wearing shoes. So anyway, I presume that was why it was commissioned in 1968-69, just in case this crazy conspiracy theory turned out to have a grain of truth in it. But yeah, the real question, though, is how it stood there for 30 years without anybody touching it.
Let's go back a bit to talking about your writing life and come back to the obituaries in a second. When do you remember first being a writer or first being interested in writing?
I suppose always, you know. I mean, at school it was the one thing that I excelled in and the one thing I enjoyed, more to the point. When I was in my late teens, I wrote a few pieces for music fanzines. Yeah, I went to work for Tribune, the Labour Party left-wing weekly, in 1980... and that was because that was another interest at the time anyway, kind of left-wing Marxist politics, and I'd worked for Tony Benn at Westminster, and that led to the job on Tribune.
So when you worked for Tony Benn, was that a writing related role as well?
No, not really. Tony didn't need anyone to help him write his speeches. It was much more mundane than that. Although, I mean, I was writing for other kind of left-wing publications, London Labour Briefing and Socialist Organiser and so on. So I was writing. And then the two interests, politics and writing, came together with the job on Tribune.
Mm. And then from there, so you moved from doing these jobs that were motivated by your interest in politics into being a writer more generally and doing things that weren't necessarily related to politics?
Well, I'll tell you very, very briefly the trajectory. I became editor of Tribune, and then I was headhunted by Neil Kinnock to be editor-in-chief of the Labour Party's publications. So I worked for the Labour Party for several years, including over the 1987 general election when I was one of Kinnock's press officers on the campaign. And then, in fact, it was from there that I joined the Times political staff. My first job on the paper was on the political staff. And it was a good job because I had two columns on the op-ed page as well, kind of diary columns of sort of snippets of Westminster gossip, which was great because the Times had a huge political staff and I was about number five. You know, so I wasn't doing the Downing Street briefings. I was really getting the crumbs. But having these two diary columns a week was really, you know, what made the job worthwhile and gave me something to get my teeth into.
That must have been great fun. I mean, digging out stories for those columns. You know, I mean, was it sort of going, were you sort of spending a lot of time at Westminster having interesting conversations with people?
Oh yeah, I mean,
I was based
at Westminster. I mean, yeah. The Times, I think it's got a smaller office there now, but at the time, it had this huge, huge office in the press gallery that was the size of, you know, take any other three newspapers, and they still had less space than we had put together. Perhaps I was occasionally a little bit envious of Robin Oakley was the political editor, Phil Webster was his deputy. Phil then became political editor. You know, they'd go off to the 11 o'clock or 4 o'clock briefing at number 10, and perhaps I was a little bit envious occasionally that I wasn't doing that, but I kind of was having more fun than they were, because I was kind of going around the tea rooms and getting all the sort of juicy little bits of gossip and filling my diary column with that.
Sounds like a great job to me. So at what point did you start writing obituaries and how did that come about?
Well, I'd started writing about music for the Times, doing celebrity interviews, reviewing albums every week, and live concerts as well. And then I started doing the music obituaries. So it was a sort of natural progression, really, or outgrowth from what I was doing as a freelance. I mean, it was obviously a very lucrative gig because, A, rock stars, you're talking a kind of high-risk profession. Secondly, by the time I started doing it towards the end of the 1990s, you know, the people who'd been stars in the 50s and 60s were already getting on. So there was a pretty steady flow of work there. At that time, I was still doing all the celebrity interviews and the rest of it as well. So I was quite content just to do an obituary when it was in my specialist area, as it were. But gradually, since then, the obituaries came to take over my working life. Really, I still do a little bit of music writing, but that's 5% of what I do now, probably.
When we were first in touch, you made a comment that I thought was really interesting. You said that you weren't sure that you could have done obituary writing at the beginning of your career and you felt it was better to have a few more years behind you before you start doing those pieces. Would you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, I know there are some very fine obituary writers of a younger generation than me, but I don't feel that I could have written a decent obituary when I was 25 or 30 years old. I think it's, in a way, it's a huge responsibility. You are, you know, the Times prides itself on still, to an extent, being the paper of record. So an obituary in the Times is a big deal, particularly for family and friends who are left behind. So it is a responsibility. And to sum up the arc of a life that could be, you know, up to 100 years in 1,600 words or whatever your allocated count is, it's a very specific kind of writing. I mean, there are similarities. I mean, you're still telling a story, and that's common whether you're writing from Westminster about the political events of the day or whatever. A story is a story. But this is more than a story. It's not a story that is going to be overtaken tomorrow by, you know, whatever the latest twist in the political saga happens to be. It's there for all time, and it's the final word on that person's life. And I think you need I certainly feel that I benefit from a long experience and maturity. I'm 68 now. And I don't feel the writing I do now, the obituaries I write now, I could not have written them 30, 40 years ago.
Why?
I just don't feel I'd have done the person's life justice.
Mm. Do you think there's something human in the just recognizing the experience of a human life and what time passing means and all of that, you know?
I think it's exactly that. It's having that longer view and time passing, and from that perhaps being able to sift out what's important in the long term and what may have seemed important at the time but actually wasn't. And it's just that perspective that comes from having that experience and that longer view. Having said that, you know, there are people on the Times who write fantastic obituaries who are half my age, so you know, they're better journalists than I am. But I could not have written some of the obituaries that I'm asked to write today when I was a younger man.
What would you say that an obituary is for, and what should it accomplish?
Well, it tells a story, and as I said, that's the common thread in almost all journalism. You're telling a story. it has changed. I referred earlier to how, I think I was talking about Mick Jagger actually, and saying I'd had to write a new obituary because the style had changed so much that the old one was now completely redundant. And the old obituaries used to start, Mick Jagger was one of the most significant figures in the rock culture that emerged in the 1960s, blah, blah, blah. You know, and now you start with the best anecdote, perhaps. You know, in the same way as you would write any other story, you've got to draw the reader in. So you're telling a story, but you're also making a judgment, aren't you? I mean, you're assessing somebody's life, and you've only got 1,600 words, say. I mean, on someone like Jagger, it's longer, he gets a spread, so that's 2,800 words. But even in 2,800 words, you know, you're looking at an action-packed life, and you are making decisions about what to put in and what to leave out. And so the things that you put in have to be significant. And also, I mean, this is one of the ways in which the style has changed. You put in stories now that you think reflect the character of the person that you're talking about. Now, before, I would say we defined the person by their work, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was a musician or an author or a film star. You wrote about the records they'd made, the films they'd been in, the books that they'd written, and you almost defined them through their work.
The accomplishments.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if it was a non-creative thing like a politician, yes, you know, the accomplishments. But now the accomplishments still need to be in there, but in a way they almost take second place to trying to convey to the reader a flavour of this person as a human being.
It's rather beautiful, really. It's quite a lovely thing you're doing. There must be difficult decisions sometimes when things have to be taken out for space, and sometimes I imagine there are dilemmas where you think, I sort of think that this detail does tell you something important about who this person was, but I've got so much material here, it's just going to have to go.
And there are other considerations. They're very much warts and all, the obits these days. You don't leave things out, but you do have to have a consideration. Is this just gratuitous? I don't know, if someone's abandoned their spouse and children and there's been a thoroughly unpleasant court case, you know, do you need to go into the sort of granular detail? You probably need to mention it. So there are those kind of judgments that you're making as well. And I mean, very often you've actually spoken to, you know, a bereaved husband, wife, daughter, son, because we do ring people up and ask if they want to talk about the person we're writing about. And that's very interesting because there are some who are just in pieces and can't talk, but they're the minority, and a very small minority, actually. I would say they're probably no more than 10-15%. Most people, you begin by saying, you know, I'm sorry to take your time at this terrible moment, and quite understand if you don't want to talk, and you can't stop them talking. Mm. It's almost like a therapy for them to talk about the person that they've just lost. And you know, frequently I'll ring somebody up expecting to get a flea in my ear or 5 minutes at best, and an hour later I'm still on the phone to them. And people will say, oh, thank you so much for taking the time and trouble to write about my whoever it is. You know, it's quite touching.
Do you ever worry that if there is something in the obituary that is, you know, is a bit warts and all and is not maybe the thing that their widower is going to want to read about? Do you ever worry about how they're going to feel about that?
That's why I raised it at this point of the discussion, I think, really, because... you could easily be influenced by that, having spoken to the person. I mean, I would like to think it doesn't affect what you write, but perhaps it just makes you a little more thoughtful about what is gratuitous and what is essential.
Mm. It's you've already said something which I was going to ask you about, which was, I remember when I was at the Times, I think I was sitting next to a sort of a desk that was a kind of hot desk that different people would sit in. And I think on one occasion I was next to a sub-editor who was working on obituaries. And I remember them saying to me, the days that I do obituaries are in some ways the hardest days, because the obituaries desk is perhaps the most rigorous desk on the paper in terms of making sure that everything is absolutely correct. And as you say, the Times considers itself a newspaper of record, and these are I suppose documents that are going to perhaps be reread in 100 years and represent somebody's life, and you have to get that right. Do you feel a sense of responsibility? I mean, it sounds like you do.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that it is a pressure for the subs. I think as the writer, the pressure is a little bit different. I mean, obviously you want to be factually accurate, but I feel that the obituaries should be the best written copy in the paper, and I think by and large they are. And I'm not talking about my own here. I'm talking about all of my colleagues, partly because we write the stocks, so you have time to write a considered piece. You know, it's not like a news piece that you're just banging it out. Partly because of the responsibility of summing up someone's life, and you know, I mean, you were talking about it might be on the record for 100 years, and you know, we anthologize the best obituaries in books, so you know they have a life that goes on. So there is that sense of responsibility. I hadn't thought about the subs, actually. Yeah.
Poor subs. They have a very important role.
I mean, I talk to them all the time, and you know, so they do ring up and say, are you sure about this? And sometimes you feel a bit irritated and get a bit short with them. But, you know, we've had this conversation. I hope next time I'll be a little bit more considerate.
I noticed reading the latest book of obituaries that the Times has published, which has many of your obituaries in it, that they do follow a particular structure, which seemed to me to be a colourful, as you say, a sort of colourful opening, and perhaps a whole series of anecdotes that illustrate something about the person's character. Then at some point in the obituary, there's a bit of a back to the beginning. Then you have a chronological account of this person was born in this year and they, you know, they married twice and blah, blah, blah. Also bringing in some of the colour. Have I summed it up? Is that the sort of format?
You've got it. Okay. You rumbled us. Yeah, I mean, that is very much it. I mean, the first third at least of the obituary is very readable, very colourful, all the best stories. Then at some point you have to do the kind of factual chronological thing. So as you say, you go back to the beginning, so-and-so was born in blah, 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 and then do a bit of a chronological thing. But you've kept back a few of the good stories from the first third of the obituary so that you can insert them as you go through the chronological process, so that, you know, otherwise people would just stop reading when they got a third of the way through. And then you need a good sign off. So, you know, that's the structure of it, really.
Yeah.
The intro and the sign off are important. Yeah, I mean, would anybody actually want to read an obituary that begins, you know, Mick Jagger was born in Dartford in 1941?
No. So your research must be absolutely meticulous. And I mean, when I was reading your obituaries, I was thinking, God, this is a really, really thorough research job. And you're certainly not using Wikipedia.
going back to the subs, if I can. That is when they can be really annoying, when they ring you up and they say, you said such and such. It says in Wikipedia.
So tell me, what is your sort of research process? Are there things that you're drawing on again and again? Are there particular books that are very useful? Who are you tending to make calls to? You know, is it kind of previous colleagues of the person? Is obviously you mentioned a spouse or a family member. If you could sort of describe in general terms a method, what are you covering off?
Yeah, I mean, it does vary. I mean, the ones where you actually speak to people are different. The ones that you write without talking to colleagues or family, the process is, well, my process is, I mean, I just assemble everything I can, you know, interviews, profiles, anything that I can find on the internet. I will often use books. We'll use the cuttings. And again, the Times has got a very good cuttings library. And that can be particularly useful because they will turn you up original cuttings or photocopies of original cuttings pre-digital era. You know, there is a whole kind of raft of stuff out there that has never gone onto the internet. Basically, anything published in a newspaper before about 1990, you're unlikely to find it on the internet. So that can be very, very useful. And then what I do when I've put everything in a great long file, and it might be sort of 15,000-16,000 words long or something, of all these interviews and profiles and everything I can find. And then I'll go through that, chopping bits out and putting them into another file, which might get down to sort of 6,000 words. And then I'll do the same thing all over again and get it down to 2,000 words, and then you're in business. So
I don't know how you manage to do four or five of those a week. That is a lot of work.
Those tend to be the stocks, really, yeah. when you can do it that way. I mean, if you've got a full day to do it, then yes, I would. That would be my chosen modus operandi.
And are you getting hold of autobiographies and biographies as well, or is there just generally not enough time to be doing that?
Well, on the stocks, most definitely. Yep. You have to go out and buy the book because you can't get any expenses out of this lot. But I suppose that makes up for all those lunches all those years ago. But yeah, I mean, I will quite happily go and spend £20 on a biography or an autobiography if I'm writing a sort of real major spread 2,800 word obituary.
Do you ever draw on your journalistic colleagues in terms of thinking, well, because often journalists know people, don't they? So I'm sure often you're writing about somebody, you know, who either somebody else at the Times has interviewed them or actually knew them socially, or are you making those sorts of calls?
Yeah, very much so. You know, you'd be foolish not to use that as a resource. I'm not going to name names, but what tends to work less well is, you know, the great and the good. You know, you get told that this former editor was a great friend of so-and-so, and you ring them up, and I'm sorry, but 9 times out of 10, they're useless. They've got nothing to tell you that you can use. It's people further down the food chain, really, that tend to have the best stories, who've actually interviewed these people, rather than, you know, an editor who's had dinner with this person at some high table somewhere.
I read your Hilary Alexander obituary, and I interviewed Hilary Alexander about 10 years ago and got so much colour from meeting her, because she was just that kind of person. She was a dream person to interview. I mean, I remember I interviewed her at her house, and she got me to pick up cigarettes and newspapers on my way over. So even that was just fun. And I read your obituary and thought that must have been a very easy and fun one to do, relatively speaking, because you must know so many people who knew her.
Yeah, I mean, that was a classic example of where fellow journalist colleagues were a source of a lot of the stories in there.
You mentioned that you've done some obituaries for people who you'd actually interviewed yourself. And are those, I imagine those must be really quite nice to do, those ones, because you're then coming at it with your own sort of personal impressions of the person, and not just having to rely on other people's accounts.
Yeah, very much so. You know, you even if you've only spent an hour with somebody interviewing them, you know, you've got some kind of a feel of their character and their personality, what makes them tick. You can also use your own quotes from your interview rather than, you know, so-and-so told the Daily Telegraph, which we don't like saying for obvious reasons. So, yeah, I mean, that does help. It's also sometimes rather sad, you know, because you've got to know these people and you're now writing their obituary. Mm. So the ones that I really enjoy writing are probably the non-music ones. I mean, what's happened over the years, for whatever reason, the obituaries editors, successive ones, like what I do, and they've asked me to do more. So, you know, it grew from just doing the music ones. Then I started doing some of the sort of film Hollywood type ones because, oh, yeah, that's sort of celebrity culture. And then it grew into just, you know, doing almost anything. And the curveballs became the most fun to write. You know, from ended up writing about royalty, which as a Republican is hilarious, really. comedians. I mean, Ken Dodd was a great one.
That was a very well written
obituary. I really enjoyed doing that. I mean, they sent me the stock, and the first thing I noticed when I read the stock was there's not a single joke in it. Mm. How can you write Ken Dodd's obituary without at least putting a couple of his best jokes in there?
Yeah. Forgive me if this is too philosophical a question, but do you think doing this kind of work perhaps helps you grapple with life and death and think about mortality and that kind of thing in a different way?
Well, I think it genuinely does. I mean, we were talking earlier about why I felt I couldn't have written these obituaries in the way that I do now 30 or 40 years ago. And I've thought of the word, actually, after we'd had that part of the conversation, it's ripeness. And I think that sums it up, really. And you have a sort of view of your own life as ripe, as well as the people you're... So there is definitely that connect. I mean, you've hit it on the head. I was struggling, really, to think why I feel... this is the right time in my working life to be writing obituaries, and I'm glad that I wasn't doing it 30, 40 years ago. You've made me think about that, and I think the word ripe sums it up, actually.
Do you think that they'll run an obituary for you when you go?
Well, we always run obituaries our own. I mean, sometimes the readers will make sarky comments about, another Times journalist has pop their clogs and here's the obituary, but it seems to me fair enough. You know, I mean, it is a national newspaper, it's not a trade journal, but I think it would be very odd if we didn't honour our own. And that's the saddest thing of all, you know, that you end up writing the obituary of somebody that you might have worked alongside for 20 years.
Do you trust them to do a good job though when the moment comes?
Well, I hope they'll do a thoroughly salacious job and, reveal all my darkest secrets, because at least that means everybody will read it.
Maybe they'll quote from this interview. You never know. Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
Tight deadlines, which never used to worry me. It's only doing the obituaries because, as I've explained, you know, I have a completely different approach to doing those, and I regard them as a different kind of journalism. So tight deadlines, and the way that they've got worse because of the online pressure. Other than that, no. I mean, the interesting thing is, I think, as I was saying, the less I know about a subject, the more enjoyment I seem to get of writing about it. I recently got asked to do the obituary of I can't even remember his name now, but he was the boxing referee who stopped the Tyson Holyfield fight when Tyson bit the guy's ear off. I know nothing about boxing. I actually loathe boxing, but I really enjoyed getting stuck into it and doing that obituary. And it's almost now, I know a lot about rock music. A rock star dies, and it's kind of, I've got to do another rock star. If someone said, you've got to do another boxing referee, that would be more exciting in a way.
I totally can see that. And I think in many ways, obituary writing seems like sort of peak journalism to me, because what I love about journalism is that you have this, you're allowed to be as nosy as you want about whatever you want, and you get access to all kinds of people and resources that you wouldn't otherwise have to sort of satisfy your curiosity. And to be telling people's life stories, I just can't think of anything more interesting.
Yeah.
Do you remember any moments in your writing career where either somebody's given you a bit of advice or feedback, or you've just had a bit of a personal breakthrough that has really improved your writing?
The best bit of advice I think I was ever given, apart from, you know, how to fill in your expenses form, actually came from the same person, Phil Webster. And it was on my first day at Westminster. I was writing a news story, and I must have been struggling with the intro. And Phil said to me, just carry on writing, leave the intro, write the story, and then go back, put the top on it at the end. And it doesn't just have to be the intro. It's just you can apply that at any point in the piece, I think. If you get stuck, just move on. Just move on, carry on writing, and go back to it. Go back to the sticky point, sort it out afterwards. And probably by the time you've written the rest of the piece, the problem will somehow miraculously have evaporated. So that's a piece of advice I would pass on to anybody else. Just move on. If you get stuck, do not sit there kind of stewing over it. Just move on, go back and fix it later.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah, because I think as a young writer, you can get stuck and start to really sort of hate yourself because you can't fix this thing. But actually, often by the time, as you say, by the time you've reached the end, the answer becomes clear and it's much more obvious what you should have done.
And it can be particularly acute on an intro. As I said, it applies anywhere in the piece, I think, if you get stuck. But particularly on the intro, because, you know, if you're struggling with the intro and you get the idea into your head that you can't continue until you've got the right intro, you're never going to get the piece written at all.
Awful. And looking back on your writing career, what do you feel the most proud of?
I think the obituaries. I really do. You know, and you pick up the book, which, as you kindly pointed out, contains a lot of mine, the Latest Times anthology. And I read them and... Yes, I'm sorry, I do feel quite proud of them. Whereas, you know, if I got my old cuttings book out from 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I would probably cringe at a lot of what I'd written then. So it would be nice to think that the craft does improve as you get older, you know, like... I don't know, you know, a craft like a cabinet maker or a painter or, you know, not sure it applies to the rock musicians I write about, you know. So we talked about Mick Jagger, who probably did his best work when he was 25, you know, so it's the complete opposite. But in terms of craft, one would like to think that you learn and go on learning. And that means that you get better.
Thank you so much to Nigel Williamson for speaking to me. I hope it made for a good listen. Do come and let me know on Twitter or Instagram. You can read some of Nigel's wonderful obituaries and many more from The Times in their most recent anthology, Lives Less Ordinary. I'm going to put a link to that in the episode notes, along with some links to some of Nigel's most recent pieces. I'll include his obituary of Hilary Alexander, as well as my interview with her, which I wrote in 2013 for The Cut. A reminder before we go that if you want to write your life story or anything else, you can get started today with a short online course at Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off and visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you happen to be in London, I am doing an event in Hammersmith next Tuesday with the London Writers Salon, and tickets are available. I'm going to link to that in the notes. I'll be back here with another episode next week, this time with a much-loved novelist. Bye for now.